Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. It is now or never. And if you're looking to, do not hesitate. Don't hesitate if you're looking to either join or create a prayer circle. I mean, I think that it's more than appropriate to always petition him, ask and ye shall receive, knock and it shall be given unto you. Those types of things are clearly a part of the Christian faith. So let's exercise that faith. And so we have one more thing. That debt clock is a capture of the amount of fraud that the people are being levied upon the people. And so I can't emphasize enough that we need to start understanding the Constitution. You need to understand the Constitution. And as a matter of fact, I was just talking to Tammy. Welcome back, Tammy. About the Wyoming state constitution. And I think this is applicable for every single one of you. You need to go, because I was trying to get the list of every constitutional amendment to your state constitution. You know, when, not the actual amendments, all of them that were submitted. In other words, you want to look at all of the ones that were attempted in the past. And then you want to, you know, identify out of those which ones actually did pass. And so that way you can look at where those fell into your state constitution. Why is this so important? And as I was explaining this to Tammy, there was a article, or actually a post in social media. I think Ginger Bennett, somebody you know, posted something about the Wyoming Pharmaceutical Board and how they're starting to make some decisions and, you know, deciding what they're going to inflict upon the good people of Wyoming. And I pointed out that there has been no delegation of authority from the people to the state to grant them the ability to regulate your pharmaceutical products. In other words, it's not there. And so this person piped up and said, oh, yeah, you can find it in this section, in this section, this article and section, this article and this section in the Wyoming State Constitution. And this was the most feeble attempt I've ever seen, because I said that, you know, this is what they say, and this is what, you know, this is what this article says, the section that you pointed out, this section, this point out, and it's not there. And then, you can find it within the language that it's applicable, that they can do that. And I'm going, here is the ample evidence of how ignorance to the Constitution is literally being applied. Because when was the state constitution written? The Wyoming state constitution was written in 1789. It was passed and Wyoming became a state, I believe, in 1890. It's 89, 90, somewhere there. So in other words, when you read those articles and those sections in those articles, because there's no reference in the state constitution that those sections were actually considered an applied amendment. In other words, this was amended by this way, because usually they'll kind of include how that section was amended by which amendment. And so there's no reference to the amendment at all. And when you read these sections, again, one of them was really talking about the ability, and this is the beautiful thing, if you actually read this, and I'll give it to you later. If you read this, the Wyoming State Legislature has the responsibility granted. I mean, the people basically gave them the responsibility to protect the morality of the people. In other words, to make sure that they wouldn't have the education system inflicted with obscene material.
Yeah, I've actually read that one. I was shocked to read it.
And this person was using that to say, oh, you can see right there that they're giving them the ability to regulate pharmaceutical. And so the reason why this is so important, friends, is you need to find out when the language was written for that part that they're talking about. Because I'm going to guess in 1889, when that constitution was written, they were not even thinking at all about pharmaceutical companies or drugs at all. None. Yeah. I mean, there may have been, if there was some reference to snake oil salesmen, because back in those days, there was no such thing as a pharmacy. There may have been a general store where you would get, you know, your own drugs, bicarbonate or what have you, or the doctor would have access to some of those, you know, because you got to remember that we were just getting past the bloodletting if you got sick. I mean, medicine had not advanced well until the 1900s when Rockefeller started getting involved in pharmaceutical engineering. So come on. I mean, so folks, you need to have not only your state constitution in hand, you need to have a full list of every time the people or the legislature tried to take a whack at it. Now, unfortunately, it's way too easy to amend a state constitution. As a matter of fact, it is the process of amending the state constitution is unconstitutional. Because it is not a Republican form of governing. It's not a Republican form of changing that constitution. It's literally an enactment of democracy.
Right.
And when you have the ability to use democracy to change your government, you are literally allowing your government to toss, you know, go back to and fro, being literally, you know, pushed in all these different directions. When you know, we need stability in government, which is one of the reasons why they had supermajority requirements to literally change the founding document of the government. So why is it that the states just marginalized how important that state constitution was? Probably because the counties didn't understand that down the road, the government would start taking on every aspect of your life and start regulating you into ad nauseum. So anyway, so where we left off, and so folks, I'm just challenging you to make sure you go get it. You go get your state constitution. You go find those amendments. If you can't find them, then as I just told Tammy, you need to go to your Secretary of State and say, I'd like to see a timeline of every time there was an attempt to amend the Constitution and then, you know, which ones actually got amended so that we can actually see the history of our great Constitution. And so the Secretary of State should actually have all of that. And it's sad. I mean, I can come up with, and you can go to Wikipedia and you can find every time there has been an attempt on amending the state or the United States Constitution, it's almost pretty thorough. The one thing I did notice that Wikipedia does not include the Jefferson Amendment. The only way you find the Jefferson Amendment is on Avalon. So anyway, so let's dive back into Article 4. We just started covering Section 3. And this is so important, folks. This is the admission of states into the Union. We covered this in the Constitutional Convention, Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, and unfortunately we didn't have Tammy because she was just having all these vacations throughout the summertime. I mean, no, you were actually campaigning and trying to unseat this lawyer that was, you know, already an incumbent that was already in office, and I know you had your hands full in trying to do that, so... What we want to do is I just want to give you the insight of what we covered in the Constitutional Convention. So in the very beginning, and it was really literally in the very beginning under the Virginia Plan that it was thrown out there that they wanted to submit new states into the Union on a lower footing. In other words, the northeastern states and the southern states kind of agreed... I mean, most all the states kind of agreed that any new state that joined the Union would not have the same representation. Maybe they'd have, you know, half the representation or even worse, you know, one third, one fourth, so that they wouldn't come into the Union with equal footing. And so that didn't bode very well. And Mason was the first one in June to say, are you kidding me? You really want to do to these new states that joined the Union what Britain did to us? Because we, you know, our whole point of this revolution was we, as colonies, didn't have equal footing. We didn't have representation for our taxation. We wanted okay. equal representation for taxation. They're going to tax us. We should have equal footing. Now, this was one of the reasons and why it was included in the Constitution, going all the way back to Article 1, Section 8, because we covered this. And I pointed out that states, only states, paid taxes. If you were a territory, you would not be subject to taxation. So that way there was this impetus for the federal government to say, you know what? We can't allow territory to just sit out there. Well, what happens when all of a sudden you have this way of just squeezing and shaking the tree and getting more taxes out of it? Well, then the need to take territories and make states out of them just goes away. When you have the ability as a federal government to just take everything you want from the states that you have to pay for whatever you want to do, and you can literally get away with murder, then why would they have any need to start, you know, admitting new states into the Union? Thus, Puerto Rico right. has been sitting out there, the Virgin Islands, or I should say, Guam, Somalia, all of these places that are considered territories. Well, they don't have to transition them. They don't have to worry about admitting them as a state. So that becomes a huge problem, because now they claim that they have full autonomy and full control over the people of those states. And you would think that the people, you know, technically by the exclusive legislation, we read in Article 1, subsection 17, that they shall have exclusive legislative powers over all territories and over the district. I would love to see Congress actually start really inflicting, you know, just terrible powers over those folks. The question is, if the District of Columbia, which is a territory, it is not a state, nor can it be a state, has the ability to now, under the Constitution, have the same privileges of a state because it has they've given them the Electoral College status unconstitutionally. And I mean this because even though they amended the Constitution, that amendment violates the actual essence behind the fact that the District of Columbia, the District of Columbia was to be autonomous. So in other words, if you moved into the District of Columbia, you would be giving away your ability to vote for an elector. You're not to have one. Only states had the electors. Only states had the electors. Only states had representation. So they tried to just change that. And in other words, this goes down the path of how government loves to remove the consequences of sin. So right. what they try to do is they say, oh, well, because you can't do this, then we want to actually change that so that we can do this. And so that's what they do, and that's what they've been doing. But why is it that Guam, why is it that all these other territories, Somalia, why aren't they saying, hey, where's our representation for the electors? Why can't we actually have our own elector, like D.C.?
Yeah.
The reason why is because only states could participate in the choosing of the president. You had to have a state. And D.C. was never to be a state. That was the design. So in other words, you move or you live in a territory, you either have to work on transitioning that territory. But if you live in D.C., it can never be a territory. It is the district. It is the seat of government for the federal government. Now, it's way too big. They don't need all those buildings because they don't have the authority to actually operate all of those powers that they've assumed. If we got rid of the Department of Education and Transportation and all these unnecessary unconstitutional departments, then D.C. would become a ghost town. Oh, wow. What would happen to the housing market in the D.C. area? It'd be the first time it ever crashed.
Yeah.
because it's only been growing and growing since its inception. Anyway, so putting the reality aside, now let's dive into the black and white of law, which is the U.S. Constitution. So again, remember, every state that was to join the Union was to join with equal footing. Show me anywhere, when we finish this, if you can, anybody listening, where is the there where they have the ability to diminish the power of a state joining the Union? Just show me, because that's what we've basically been doing to all of the Western states by taking away resources. Do they have the ability to create permanent law and create permanent leverage, or I should say, let me call it a burden. In other words, taking away the land, the resources of a state. You know, let's say it's a very, you know, forested area, and so one of your biggest resources would be your forest, and say you can't have access to that forest. In other words, taking away the valuable resources that that state is coming into existence to be. So let's go ahead. You read that very first line again. And so the very first line in red is the identifying of what this article or this section in this article is doing.
New states, is that where we're at? Is that what you wanted me to read? New states may be admitted by the Congress into this union.
Okay, so right there, that right there identifies who has the authority to admit new states into the union. Is it the Supreme Court?
No, just Congress.
Just Congress. Not the president, not the Supreme Court. Only Congress has the power to admit new states into the union. Going back to the 14th Amendment, when those states abandoned the union, they left the union, and they formed a new confederation, and they sent their representation into that new confederation. Were those states, during the Civil War, in the confederation, were they a part of the union?
No.
No. Sometimes the questions are really that easy. You know, because these point out the stupidity or the idiocy or the imbecility of the individual saying, oh, well, those states could come right back into the union. No, they can't. When those states, because this argument has been submitted to Congress in many different ways. Oh, well, they couldn't keep those states out. Absolutely, they could. Those states left the union. And yeah. Only Congress had the power. Those radical Republicans said, you can't come back in, because we have this authority, and the criteria for you to come back in is either you amend or ratify the 14th Amendment, or you wait until it is ratified before we let you back in. That's what they did. They had the authority, because right there, new states may be admitted by Congress into this union, not the president, not the Supreme Court, not by other states or other nations that aren't in the union. Well, China says we can come in. So I want to take this to this point, because understanding the position of a state in this union, this means that these states are becoming equal partners. It's like husband and wife in a union. But instead, in this marriage, there are 50 parents. One is not above the other. They're all equal partners in this marriage, in this union, under this Constitution. Therefore, when you come into the union, you are to receive equally the blessings from being a part of the union, as well as the scourge or the problems if the federal government starts getting out of line and starts doing bad things. We all have to suffer equally. This is why Madison clearly goes through, and when we get back to this, we'll go through the notes on nullification and his report on the Virginia resolutions, how the states must equally suffer as well as be equally blessed. That they have to make sure that if they're suffering, they have to take the necessary measures and actions in getting that federal government back into check. They didn't create a government that had unlimited powers. They created a government that had very limited and defined powers. And if they choose, if the government chooses to get out of whack and the states do nothing, then they're allowing themselves to actually get into this position. But the getting out of this position is very quick and very easy. The states have all the authority to force the federal, you don't have that power. You know, and instantly, it's almost like they're the creators of the federal government. The federal government is the creature that has been created by their ratifying that amendment or that constitution. Therefore, they're just like God. They're the creators, these 50 bodies, these 50 parties. They're the creators and the overseers of that federal government. Mm-hmm. Federal government has no superior authority over those states, over those parties, if it's not enumerated in the Constitution. And yet we look at how the federal government is waging war and killing the people and attacking the states with chemtrails, with all of this unconstitutional tyranny. Why are the states allowing this to persist? Pretty tough. Pretty tough to follow. Yeah. But let me get back to Section 3. So go ahead and finish reading, because these are now some stipulations of, okay, so only Congress has the ability, but these are the only ways states can kind of join. And then the next paragraph that we're going to get into are the ancillary powers of this. So go ahead and finish that first paragraph.
Okay. But no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress.
Okay.
You want me to keep going?
No. Okay. So those are the little caveats in the creation of states. Now they're going to explain what power, or, you know, what are they giving? What are the states? Because remember, the Constitution was written for and by the states to empower this little creature to do some things. So this is what they've given them the ability. And, you know, so go ahead and let's just read the very first part, which go to the semicolon belonging to the United States. It ends right there. Go ahead.
The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States.
Okay, so that means that while it's a territory, because they said respecting the territory, that Congress shall have the power to make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory. Does it say that they can make all needful rules and regulations respecting the states in the Union?
No.
No, it says the territory and other property belonging. So in other words, the District of Columbia, or let's say this, you know, Fort Hood, or, you know, actually, Fort Myers? Belvoir, you know, some of the eastern state, you know, forts that existed and they still kind of exist today. That is federal property. And so they can make the needful rules and regulations for the Army or for the Navy or for whatever, you know, installation that they had to create for national security that was within the enumerated powers up in Article 1, Section 8. Remember, there's those only, you know, the forts, magazines, arsenals, shipyards, and needful buildings. So those were the only legitimate properties that they could possess within states. So
what about military bases?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Okay. If you understand what a fort, magazine, and arsenal, those are military, and shipyard would be a naval base.
So the only property they can hold is the District of Columbia, military bases, ports.
Yes, and we're going into a break really quick here. So, folks, when we come back from the break, we'll dive more into this. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so back to this land and property that the federal government could actually possess legitimately. First off, they have to buy the land. So as I've said this before, let's say when Indiana came into the Union and it had forts. They already had cavalry forts, places where the cavalry was being housed and doing their job and dealing with the threats in the territory. And so when they came into the Union, those forts that they had actually became state property. So what should have happened, and as a matter of fact, they didn't do this because, you know, because technically the state could have said, no, get out. We're going to take care of this. We're going to have our own militia. We're going to do this. So this is how the federal government started playing the game, going, well, you know, we already created that. It'd be kind of stupid for us to have to pay for something we already paid for. So we're just going to assume that land. And I think maybe they allowed the state, or the state allowed the federal government to maybe lease the land or what have you, because it's clear that they're supposed to purchase that land.
Mm-hmm.
So the only land that they could purchase, or for the purposes and the intent for them to be able to own any land within a state, was for national security purposes, period. So down the road, when we started creating aircraft and we needed to have training and the ability to, you know, develop good fighter pilots so that they could go to war, because if we had to practice, because we couldn't practice in the United States, we'd have to practice our, you know, bombing and teaching pilots on, you know, targets in other countries. So we had to create these military installations that were capable of providing the adequate training for the types of warfare that we were, you know, having to engage in because of technology expanse. So it doesn't hurt my head to have these artillery ranges, you know, for throwing, you know, bombs a far distance, because as we got better at being able to fight and kill people from a distance, we needed to have those ranges to be able to develop, you know, and train the troops or the Marines, what have you, to actually go and do, you know, their fighting overseas. So I can see how it would, you know, quickly allude to those pieces in the in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 16, the property or what have you, the enumeration of property, that it would include any form of military installation. However, to be clear, as Madison and the framers stated, they really needed to change the language. They couldn't make an implication. So one of the things they would have needed to add to that part of Article 1, Section 8 would have been, and again, that's Article 1, Section 8, subsection 16. It is 16, not 17. Is the needful, necessary and proper laws. That's the necessary and proper clause. So the needful rules, the needful regulations, or what have you, and the needed property, that is in subsection 16. And for them to have bombing ranges and artillery ranges, they would actually need to include training ranges because the forts means the bases, forts and bases. So if either that or they just had to call all the Marine bases forts, you know, and any type of military installation needed to be called a fort, magazine, or arsenal. Well, they started playing with what they called those things. But clearly, training ranges was something that was a little bit different because it was a large piece of land. Folks, if you don't think these pieces of land are huge, go look at some of the military bombing ranges like what we see, you know, Top Gun and the military bombing ranges that they use out there in, what is it, Fort Irwin is one, and the Nellis Air Force Base. I mean, almost all of Nevada and a good part of California is nothing but bombing ranges, artillery ranges, and so forth. 29 Palms is a huge base for military bombing and so forth. So, anyway, the fact is that that is the only land, period, that they have the authority to possess, okay? And so when we look at Article 4, Section 3, when we see the Congress have the power to dispose of and make needful rules and regulations respecting the territory, they're talking about disposing of the territory. In other words, admitting it into the Union. In other words, we're done with possessing this territory. We're ready to start taxing it. We're now rubbing our grubby mitts so we can get money, a pound of flesh out of this state. Because it transitions from a territory to a state. And so, anyway, so they have the ability to make the rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States, which means those military installations that they retain or that they've paid for. Then technically, they should have paid for those things by keeping them there. They may not have had to pay for the material, but they should have respectfully paid for the land that they were taking up, for whatever that value was. And the states that did this, as they started moving into this, many of the states, like I know California, leased that land, which is why when they didn't need that land anymore, they just said, we're shutting down your lease. We're not renewing that. You can get rid of this installation because we don't think it's necessary. We don't think we have any issues in the state of Iowa where we need these forts anymore. Right? Because, you know, we don't have the British or the French or, you know, Indian tribes or those types of things with that are actually committing warfare against the people that have, you know, peacefully settled into the state of Iowa. Okay. Right. So go ahead and read the last half of this now.
Okay, and nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state.
Okay, so in other words, now that they admit this state, and now that they're going to make these needful rules and regulations, right, because this is a second clause to what they just added, and nothing in this Constitution be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States with another nation or of any particular state. So in other words, if all of a sudden the state became was admitted into the Union, none of the claims under the United States, any of the United States claims cannot prejudice the state's claims either. So in other words, they have to make sure that when they actually, you know, make that state, that state has its full autonomy, that they can't prejudice any of the claims, you know, hey, like these are our salt mines, these are our minerals, these are our trees. You can't take those things from us. And so when Western states actually started coming in and they started creating these caveats in the Enabling Act to say, you know, these forests, you have to reserve those as federal land. That created a prejudice against that state.
There's lots of prejudice against Wyoming then.
That's right. Many of the Western states have been deeply, deeply hit by prejudices or claims by the United States against that state. Absolutely. Okay, so that should help everybody understand the admitting of states into the Union. Now, Section 4, the last part of Article 4, which is what a lot of people like to think and remember, but they kind of forget some of this stuff. But let's go ahead.
The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion.
So that right there is the entire guarantee clause. The guarantee clause does not only guarantee a republican form of government. It guarantees that the states will be republican in form and will be protected from invasions, which means an invasion on the southern border. Every state in the union is to be protected from that invasion. Is Wyoming being impacted by invaders that have come across the southern border?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know too much here in Warland, but definitely.
Okay. So, folks, every state in the union is being overran, or at least has illegal invaders, and as well as illegal or unconstitutional refugees being thrown into them. In other words, the federal government is actually waging warfare, cultural warfare, against every state and the good citizens of that state by allowing these invaders that don't speak our language, that have no right being here. They're not even supposed to be here. They're in full denial and in full violation of a uniform act of naturalization, which are the immigration laws of how a person is to migrate to the United States.
Yeah.
And this is so frustrating, and everybody says, what do we do? Well, when we actually have an invasion, because the federal government guarantees to protect you, what do you do, Tammy?
Petition?
Well, you okay, we're going to petition the federal government, but what are we going to petition them to do?
Protect us from the invasion?
And how are they supposed to do that?
With the militia.
There you go. Article 1, Section 8, subsection, what is it, 14, 15? 14. To provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. In other words, that's what they're supposed to do. They have the power to do it. Do it. Do it in this invasion today. Fulfill your legal obligation. You've swore to take an oath to support this Constitution, and the Constitution demands that you repel invasions.
Isn't Texas doing that already?
Well, so Texas is doing something, but they're doing it at their own expense. In other words, the federal government is failing to actually execute this part of the Constitution. Okay, so let's read the last half of this.
And I have a whole bunch of notes. That's why I'm trying to read through my notes.
Okay.
And on application of the legislature or of the executive, when the legislature cannot be convened against domestic violence.
Okay, so not only are they responsible for repelling the invasion, but they're also to address insurrections as well. That's what that last part means. Against domestic violence. When the people are rising up in civil unrest. So how do they do this? On application of the legislature. So remember when all the states in 2020, when the governor basically disbanded the state legislatures? Well, okay, so now that the state legislatures are out, who was supposed to actually call for the militia to be deployed to shut down these domestic riots that were happening throughout the cities of America?
I mean, the federal government.
Well, it says right there, or the executive, on application of the legislature or the executive. So, in other words, the governors were the ones that were supposed to actually say, hey, we need help because our militia can't do this. We need help suppressing these insurrections. But no governor did. No, the governors just sat there, and as a matter of fact, because the jurists, because of our judicial form of government, the judicial form of government created this unconstitutional redefining of a riot as your peaceful protest.
Right.
Because they said that is your right to basically speak out against government. So when they created this concept of you know, when you're out there protesting, you're exercising your First Amendment right. Well, if it's applicable there, then it's applicable in D.C. where they weren't burning D.C. down.
Right.
This shows the hypocrisy and the pretense that they're creating. Folks, our job is, just as Tammy said, we're to petition government for the redress of grievances. There is no right to protest. They're using this. This is how I keep telling people that anarchists, what you see as libertarians, because libertarians are out there wanting to be able to do these types of protests. They want, you know, the ability to create anarchy because they support anarchy. Libertarians and their positions today, back in 1971, they actually wanted a constitutional government. They wanted the rule of law. But they've been taken over by anarchists. Believe me, I've known people that have been a part of that party, and they've actually seen anarchists take over that party, which is why they say taxation is theft. Well, no. Taxation is a legitimate function of government for it to fund itself in those things delegated. In other words, when we see taxation, we can't have, if you take away taxation, you can't have government. Because it costs money to operate government. If all taxation is theft, then you can't have government. That's how the anarchists have injected themselves and actually got their footing into the Libertarian Party. And anarchists are actually shills. They're shills for the communist movement because they convince these people to tie their hands and say, we're not going to be involved in this. We don't want this. We want to, you know, and they're basically... their pacifist objections to any form of government, because that's what an anarchist is. And but actually, they go beyond that because they actually will institute uncivil unrest or basically civil disobedience. And civil disobedience is what they call burning down your town, destroying property, and so forth. So as we kind of look at, you know, the Libertarian Party, it has become the bastion of anarchy.
I never thought about it like that.
Right. And it is an important arm of the global communist movement to basically instill fear in the people to say, wow, does this mean I have to go and fight for my property to defend it? We're a nation of cowards because we're not in the militia. We have not been forced to function as a self-governing system, which is one of the reasons why we have all of our problems. We've abdicated our own responsibility and have demanded government to basically take care of us. We know for a fact that your police department cannot guard you. But they're going to always argue that you shouldn't have a gun so that they can actually have unfettered access to do their job. And I understand their position. They don't want to go in and think everybody has a gun. But let's just say everybody has a gun. Because that's the type of society we have. We have a society where everybody should be carrying a gun. And so let's actually live in that society so that everybody is properly trained in school. They're properly educated on their responsibilities of being an enforcer of the law. Now, if we actually were living the law, we would be able to actually identify the few people that could not actually possess a gun because they don't have the mental capacity. We could actually go down that path of saying, you know, this very select few people who cannot serve, they cannot have guns. But everybody else that goes through school and has the ability, conscious and cognitive powers and so forth, then they must have a gun. And they must be able and willing and ready to, you know, to call or come to their nation's call in defending that Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. Period. I mean, if we're all doing this, if we're all a part of the self-governing system, then all of a sudden we don't, our crime goes down dramatically because everybody is going to enforce the law.
Yeah.
And nobody should be afraid of doing so because everywhere you turn, from the store owner and your fellow customers, they're all enforcement agents. So when one person decides to actually, you know, go, what do you want to call it, have a rebellion against the law itself, they're outnumbered. Everybody around them are not rebellious.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it hard for the rebellious to even get organized because we're already organized in maintaining our liberties appertaining to us, our rights and liberties.
Yeah.
So this Constitution is such a beautiful thing. And we live in a world where we really do have, especially today, we have real serious threats, morality threats that really jeopardize our family. Anyway.
I mean, in essence, if everyone is trained in how to use a gun, then we already have the militia right there everywhere.
Well, and the only thing is the federal government is the one that's supposed to fund that. They're supposed to equip. They're supposed to be paying for this education in our school system. The one thing that they're to make sure we actually have in our school system, as a matter of fact, it is my opinion, because this is where I get in trouble when I share my opinion, because I'm not the king, folks. I'm not saying that this is how it should be. But I believe that when we really look at the formal education system, it should be shut down as far as teaching, you know, math and teaching history and all of that. The only thing the formal education, these physical school buildings should be actually doing is teaching the children tactics, militia responsibilities, you know, firearm safety, those types of things, because that is what the government is supposed to actually be funding. But I say we don't need those brick and mortar schools anymore. I honestly think that we need to get this back to the churches and the communities. Can you imagine if your churches were actually teaching people to, you know, how to function as a militia and how to work and so forth? Now, there are churches that completely abandon their responsibility in self-governing and self-protection and so forth. I mean, they're true pacifist churches out there, right? So here's the question, because we understand that the paradigm in America is that all people must be compelled, even those pastors, they must be compelled by the state. If necessary, every person must and should be compelled to take up arms to protect and defend that Constitution. So if you actually have a church that says, we're not going to do that. We stand between the government and our parishioners to say, you can't make them do that. Then how is it that that church and those people can be citizens of the United States?
Yeah.
It's equal to those churches that say, you know, we don't want the Constitution. We want to subjugate ourselves to Hadiths. We want to subjugate ourselves to Allah and these other laws. And we want the Quran to be the supreme law of the land. Then it is incompatible with being in the United States. And anybody that submits to the Quran cannot be a citizen, because the fundamental requirement of every citizen is to actually defend and support the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. Do you understand the beautiful, the concept? Because every person has a responsibility to put out and actually dispose of anything that is not congruent with the individual liberty and individual sovereignty of every citizen of the United States. So when you have religions that are undermining that, whether they're the pacifist religion or a theocracy that says, no, this is the supreme law, even a Christian theocracy is incompatible with the Constitution, because our responsibility isn't to God. I mean, this is how divine this is, because God gave us a system that actually has us protecting our individual liberties. In other words, the free agency of the individual that they must choose for themselves. In other words, the Constitution in a government form is the essence of Christianity.
The essence of free will.
Yes, it is protecting the free will and agency of all people. And if you're not on board with that, then get out of here.
Right.
There you go. And so if you want to have a pacifist church or a pacifist religion, then you have to question whether those people should be citizens or not. And then we need to go down this path of saying, do we have enough room in America to allow pacifists to take up our valuable space? Because they just get in the way. We don't want to harm them. Nobody will know and differentiate between them and us. And they could get killed.
Yeah.
It's not our job to protect them. It is our job to protect the Constitution. See?
Right.
It's not our job to protect the president. It's not our job to protect the party. It's not our job to protect our religion or ideology. It is our job to protect the one thing that guarantees our privileges and immunities cannot be taken.
Yeah.
There you
absolutely.
Go. So, this kind of turned into a sermon on the mount kind of thing, but it is that pure and that simple.
Well, and the same goes when a legislature gets into office. It's not their job to vote in accordance with the opinion of the people. It's their job to vote in accordance with the Constitution.
Right, with the powers that are enumerated in that Constitution.
Right.
In other words, if it's not delegated, don't mess with it. Which goes down the path of the pharmacy conversation we had. There's nothing that mentions that the state government of Wyoming can, you know, establish a pharmaceutical board. And yet they do that. But all of these things came in from the ACA. The American, what is it? The Act. Well, the ACA is the, it's the Obamacare, right?
Yeah, I don't even know what it stands for.
It's the Affordability Care Act. That's what it is, Affordability Care Act.
Okay.
The ACA. I believe that's what the ACA stood for. But anyway, it's the Obamacare. Bottom line, all of these regulations that have been created in every state were mandated by the Obamacare Act, enforcing them to do these types of things. So when we come back tomorrow, we're going to dive into Article 5, and we'll probably have time to dive into Article 6. Article 5 is pretty simple and straightforward. There's just really two sides of it that are really important. And then Article 6, this is where we get into the Supremacy Clause. This is where we get into the Oath of Office. Lots to cover in Article 6. And so when we come back, we'll cover those things, folks. Hopefully we'll be able to cover all of them, but we'll find out. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.